Thanks, Brother Nathan, and good morning, brothers and sisters. It's lovely to be down here with you again, or it will be in about half an hour. So, yeah, I got a little bit of anxiety going on, so I'll try and deal with that. So, the New Testament, John, first chapter of the Gospel of John, introduces us to Jesus as the one who is described as the Word made flesh. And it's something that that certainly my mind has, I believe, grown a lot in the understanding of that in the last numbers of years now, getting involved in seminars, particularly where we're teaching people about the very basics of the truth and where the New Testament gospel comes from and what exactly does it mean for Jesus to be the Word made flesh. And of course, really what it means is we describe it as being the logos or the purpose, but really it is in fact the Word, which for Jesus was the Old Testament. It was all of the books of the Bible up to Malachi. It was 39 books. It was that absorbed into a mind and lived in a body. It was the embodiment of everything that God had revealed through his prophets beforehand. And Jesus was able to absorb that and live it and breathe it and become it. And so today I can't help myself but to take an exhortation from Exodus. Because when we think of Jesus and the amazing person that he was, who he was did not come from the New Testament. It came from the Old Testament. And so everything that we see in him and all of those characteristics and all of the amazing lessons, they are embodied in the Old Testament. And so sometimes, I know growing up, I struggled with reading stuff from the law, especially there's some stuff that we would rather not read about. There's some stuff that's embarrassing. And there's a lot of stuff that we clearly have no understanding about unless we pause and consider. And there's a lot of repetition, and you say, why the repetition? And what we're going to talk about today with the tabernacle is, in fact, just in the book of Exodus, repeated three times from chapter, I think it's 25 through 36. Pretty much exactly the same account three times. And so we have to ask ourselves, as we go through these lessons from the tabernacle, like, what is this all about? We got a building, and God has taken pains to give a description of a building, and maybe go to Exodus, because we're going to take a couple of looks here as we get going at the chapter that we had, which is 36, and it goes into 37 describing the furniture. But it starts in about 25 or maybe 26, Exodus 26. And we're not going to try and cover, by any stretch, we're not going to try and cover all of the articles. In fact, I'm going to home in a minute. I'm going to home in on just one little part of the tabernacle, because really, you can't do justice to do any more than that. In fact, we can't even exhaustively do that. But the initial account of Moses being, or it being described to Moses, it starts in 24 when God calls Moses up and he gives him get to the end of chapter 24 and he's up into the cloud and he's in the mount for 40 days. And then in chapter 25, God says to Moses, speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. Every man that gives it willingly with his heart, he shall take my offering. And so the first key to understanding the tabernacle is the tabernacle is a joint venture. And it's not a joint venture of the leaders. It's not a joint venture from the tribes, but it's a joint venture, we're going to call it, from the brothers and sisters, from all of the ecclesia, from all of the Israelites. It's completely a joint venture, but it's a willing offering. And so the place where God would dwell, which is really what the tabernacle is, it's if we come to chapter 26, I don't think I wrote down the verse, or chapter 25, verse 8, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And so the tabernacle was a dwelling place for God. It was where God would dwell with men. But more than that, in verse 9 it says, according to all that I show thee, after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so you shall make it. And so the dwelling place that God was instructing Moses to make was very specific. And it was, in fact, extremely specific. Number one, it had to be willingly provided. It needed to be sourced from the entire congregation. And the whole structure or the whole structure of the instructions that was given to Moses contrasts completely with worship both in their contemporary times and specifically, if we think about it, with worship today, with let's say Christianity today, where people feel that they can worship on their terms. They can come as they are, that God will accept them as they are and where they are and for who they are. And it's all about it being on people's terms. But this, in fact, was on God's terms, and it was so specific. And when we cast through in our minds some of the things that we just read this morning, that we've got all of these instructions, we've got these sockets of silver that have got to be set in the ground, 40 to a side. Well, what is, you know, 40 comes straight to our mind, doesn't it? We've got 40 sockets down one side made of silver. We've got a period of probation. We've got redemption. And inside of those is standing these wooden boards with two tenons that are shittim wood and clad with gold, and they all stand together, and there's lesson after lesson, and these boards all stand together, and they're overlaid with four coverings, one that faces inside, which is embroidered work, and then three layers of skins, and the third layer out is ram skins dyed red, and then you've got probably a white skin on the outside, and you've got ropes, and you've got pins, and you've got fences, and then you come inside to the articles, and you've got a very specific box, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, and it's made of wood, and then you've got a mercy seat, and you've got cherubim, and it's all described in absolute detail. There was nothing left to Moses' interpretation as to how he would make these things. And so there's lesson after lesson for us about our God and about how it is that he would have us worship. And so this whole structure and every part of the structure, of course, ultimately is an incredible symbol of our Lord Jesus Christ, but it's also a symbol of the true believer. We have a speech in Acts chapter 17, and we can look this one up. Acts chapter 17, and starting from verse 24. And it's when Paul comes into Mars Hill, verse 22, he says, I perceive that you people are all altogether too superstitious because they had an altar to the unknown God. And then he says in verse 24, an eternal principle that God who made the world and all things therein, seeing he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwells not in temples made with hands. Neither is worship with men's hands as though he needs anything, sings as he gives to all life and breath. And so when we come right back to the formation of the nation as a nation and God giving them his law and giving them the ritual of their worship and offerings and the priesthood and the commandments and all of these things, God says, I want you to make me a house. I want you to make me a dwelling place. But when we come to the New Testament, in fact, before that, we come to Isaiah, and God doesn't dwell in buildings. So right from the very beginning, he said, I'm going to dwell in a building, but he wanted them, and he wants us to see so far beyond the building. It wasn't about the building. It was never about the building. It was about the people. And so there's amazing lessons that come to us from this building and the fact that it is representative of us. So God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. And in fact, in our New Testament reading, which clinched it for me today on what I would talk about, was in our Corinthians reading, we read that our body is the temple of God. God is to dwell in us. God doesn't dwell in a building. He doesn't dwell in this hall unless we're in it and God is dwelling in us. And then, of course, he does. And so this, I thought it was amazing that that came together so well with Exodus and with Corinthians today, that the tabernacle and the temple, really this message, it was persuasive for me that this was our subject. Isaiah 66 says, "Heaven is God's throne and earth is his footstool. Where is the house that you will build me and where is the place of my rest?" Isaiah says. And then God continues through Isaiah and he says, "But to this man will I look, to him who is poor and of a contrite heart and who trembles at my word." And really, it's not a New Testament concept, is it, that the temple or the tabernacle and the priesthood and all of these articles of worship, that it wasn't really about that. That was a lesson to draw them to God. And the real dwelling place was not the building, it wasn't the glitter, it wasn't the gold, it was the people. And God wanted his people to be a light-bearing people to the nation. And so this account then from Exodus provides us with a myriad of lessons. And so today we're going to mostly just focus in on one, but we'll touch on a couple. So the first obvious lesson is a lesson of service opportunities, because the very, very first thing that God says to Moses is, "I want you to take up a free will offering." So this is what we're going to do, and the materials are going to come from the congregation. And we have to absorb that, because there's all these skins, there's all this wood, there's gold, there's precious stones like the 12 stones. It actually tells us in the account, if we read it carefully, this all came from the congregation. Because we might think, well, they sent off a crew to go and get lumber, and they sent off a crew to kill animals to get skins, and they sent another crew off to Egypt to get the cotton to make the linen. That's not what it says. It actually says with whom it is found in the congregation and who gave it willingly. And so we've got all of these lessons, but the first one is a lesson of service opportunities. And we have to look for service opportunities in the ecclesia, don't we? Because God doesn't appear to Moses and come to us off of the platform and say, "We've got a service opportunity." Or he actually kind of might, but sometimes service opportunities are announced to us, but less so in our era. You know, we live in an era where we've got the benefits of Social Security and hospitals and air ambulances and all of these things that kind of take care of each other. So service opportunities to each other are less. You know, people age, they go into an aged care facility. People get sick, they go into hospital, right? And they're unemployed, they get some welfare payments. So service opportunities, that's our first lesson. This was a willing offering that the people had to make and did make. And we read in this morning's reading that they made it over and above. So to the point that Moses had to say, "You actually have to stop bringing these things," right? And I guess that also speaks to the fact that our day, the days of our service opportunities also come to an end, right? There'll come a day, doesn't there, where we no longer have that opportunity, and it may be because we fail, maybe because Christ returns, and it may be because, and I'm as guilty as this, as the next person, that, oh, I must go and visit somebody, oh, I must go and visit them, and then I hear that they've fallen asleep. And I realize that my service opportunity closed, and I didn't go. And I can't fix that, can I, except to try and fix that on the next occasion. So there's a lesson that we can take out of that, and I think that's a lesson that we can all take. Some of us are better at it, for sure. The second lesson that we can take is that ultimately the house of God is a composite structure. It's not a building, it's a bunch of individuals. And it's a bunch of individuals at any given point in time, and then we might call it, and this is what we're going to focus on today, we're going to talk about the boards of the tabernacle. And I believe that the boards of the tabernacle, each board is made of many parts, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then all of the boards standing together maybe represent all of the saints from all of the ages. It doesn't really matter how we represent that, but fundamentally we've got, it's like the New Testament with the living stones, right? We've got a temple made with many stones, and it represents many people. And so it is with the temple here. The house of God is a composite structure, and you and I are part of that structure, but it's a living house. So this morning I want to talk a little bit for a while about the boards that the temple was made out of. And the boards are made of a wood called shittim wood, and it comes from the shittar tree. And when we go through the specifications for the tabernacle, it's the only wood used in all of the construction. It's used in the structure, and it's used in the furniture. It's used in the Ark of the Covenant, in the table. It's used in the staves and the bars that go through, the staves that go through to carry the table, for instance, and the ark and the altar, and the bars that go through to hold the boards together for the structure. It's used in the pillars, and it's used in every case, it's overlaid with gold. Well, what do we know about the wood? And I guess I haven't interest in this, because this is something that I use for kids camp, and I don't have my props that I had at kids camp. But the first part of this that's interesting is, and I had a prop at kids camp, is that the boards are 15 feet high and 27 inches wide. So not dissimilar to the face of this pier, right? So each board is taller than that, but a similar-ish width. And it has to be thick enough, I'm going to suggest probably at least 4 inches thick, each board. So then we say, well, what sort of tree is a shittar tree? And it's a form of, likely, a form of acacia. So if we were to, I can't think of a tree that we have here. Maybe Clyde can think of something, but I think of a little bit like an arbutus, which is really a eucalypt, but if one that grows alone, or an oak that grows alone, and you know, doesn't really grow tall, it's going to grow out, but not very big, and very gnarly, super gnarly. So how do you cut a board like that out of a tree like that? And the answer is you can't. It's not remotely possible to cut a board like that out of a tree that at maximum is going to be about this big. And gnarly. So every board in the tabernacle is made up of multiples of pieces. And I would suggest many multiples of pieces. It had to be joined lengthways. It had to be joined thicknessways for sure. And possibly thicknessways two ways. And so you think, okay, so what does this speak of? And of course, when you step back to where we were a few minutes ago, and we're talking about this being a willing offering that was brought together, who would have had in their luggage going through the wilderness a plank like that, right? Well, of course, nobody did. But people would have had articles made of wood that were made of shittim wood that they could have potentially repurposed. There may have been some trees within Kui of where they were. Who knows? But be it as it may, the wood was brought together. The wood was part of the offerings. If we have a look at the list of things that people were asked for, it was gold, it was silver, it was brass, it was precious stones, it was fabric, it was stuff for the needlework, it was skins, it was grain for offerings, it was oil, and it was wood. And people would bring this. And then the people who worked with it would be under Bezalel and Aholiab, the skilled artificers, who would take that and craft it, and it uses the word in the King James, and made it. They crafted it, and they put it together. They finger jointed it or dovetailed it, and they took all these little pieces of wood, and they made one great big composite board out of it, that could then stand, we might recall that word is used, isn't it, that they stand in the sockets side by side, and they form the structure of the tabernacle. And you know, as I'm taking us through this mental picture, and hopefully you're with me, but to try and build a picture in us, in our minds, of what God is trying to teach the nation and what he's trying to teach us about the real house of God. The real house of God is a composite. There was little pieces of wood. There would have been somebody who said, I have a cutting board. I could spare the cutting board. It's made of wood from the shittar tree. Like, what would have people had in the wilderness? And when they went and cut a tree down, they couldn't get a 15-foot board. It's not possible. But they might have been able to get a 4-foot board that was 6 inches wide, right? And that's just how it is. And so they would have brought their offerings. And these boards, there would have been some big, you know, chunks of wood, some bigger chunks, and there would have been some smaller boards. And so it was this amazing composite. It was definitely not one huge plank. And then when we think about the cross-section of the brothers and sisters that have made up the ecclesia through the times of the Bible, we can think of big pieces of wood and small pieces of wood, can't we? We can think of the Noahs, and we can think of the Abrahams, and we can think of the Daniels. We can think of James, who was even described as a pillar in the first century ecclesia, can't we? But we can also think of Naaman's maid, who is that little piece of wood. It was like the widow's mite of an offering. It was the housewife who said, I could spare my fruit bowl. And out of my fruit bowl, we could get a little piece of wood, and it could maybe be part of the, you know, a leg of the ark, of the table for the showbread, right? Or something. And we could see, if anyone has seen furniture nowadays is quite freely available that's made of rubber wood. I don't know how many people have seen rubber wood furniture, but rubber trees are hardwood, and they actually make amazing furniture, but everything is dovetailed together. Finger jointed together, because there's no big pieces. But it's incredibly stable once it's all joined together. So that would be an example of how we actually do something similar today. So when we look at chapter 35 and verse 5-7 of Exodus, we have the commandment to gather in. So chapter 35, Moses says to the congregation of the children of Israel, this is the thing which the Lord commanded you, saying, take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. And this is an interesting thing. Verse 4 says it's a commandment. And verse 5 says, whosoever is of a willing heart. And so it's still the same today, isn't it? You know, we have commands. Christ's commands are commands, but it's still only whoever is of a willing heart. Otherwise, it can't be accepted. Let him bring an offering. And as I mentioned before, it was gold, silver, brass, purple, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skins, badger skins, wood, oil, and sweet incense, and stones, etc. And so it became this composite structure. So then we take this board. I'll just take our minds back to this board for a moment. We've got this 15-foot high board that's 27 inches wide, and it's probably made of at least dozens of pieces of wood that are all carefully crafted and joined together. And like the temple, it was done off-site. It was assembled. You can imagine when they assembled the tabernacle in the wilderness, they weren't making it. They were assembling it. And doesn't that speak to us too of our probationary period? We're being made now, and we'll be assembled as a house of God, as a house of prayer for all nations. That really is speaking of people too. But when this board was all finished and assembled together, and it's got nice pieces of wood, and it's got knotty pieces of wood, it's got some straight grain, and it's got some wiggly grain, and it's got some dark and some light. And when it's all put together and the workmanship would have been exquisite, guess what? It was all covered. It was all covered with gold. And so we have a room full of people here today that represent potentially all of those different pieces of wood, we're all different, but we're all needed. We're all part of this board. And in the eyes of God, whilst we serve our purpose, we still need covering, don't we? Our sins still need to be covered. We still, when God looks at us, he doesn't want to see the raw wood. He's going to change us and he's going to cover us over. And so when it was all said and done, all that amazing craftsmanship that went into joining all these little pieces of wood together is covered up. And what God sees is a reflection of himself in this polished gold that goes over the board. And then the boards are stood in their sockets side by side. And they're joined together with five bars, and with the middle bar, it says, passes right through the boards from one end and right through to the other. And it joins all the boards together with one rod that's made of wood and overlaid with gold. And maybe that speaks to us of our Lord. Or maybe it speaks to us of the brothers and sisters in our community over the years that have been there when we've needed it most to join us together. You know, sometimes as individual boards, we kind of want to not be with this board. You know, can I just be a board over here? And then we have some of our brothers and sisters that draw us close, and they say, no, we need to close the ranks. We need to stand together and the one rod pass through and join them together. And so we get this amazing picture that, well, to me it's amazing, that it's so much more than a structure. It's so much more than a tent. There's all of these lessons. And then as we take some of these thoughts and we scatter them through the Bible, and we can just see that the echoes bounce back from all over the place. Let's go to Ephesians 2, and we'll look at some of the echoes now that come to us, that are drawn from those who came afterwards, who looked back on it, and I think could see all of these things. Ephesians 2 and 22. Start in verse 19. Now therefore you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together grows unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. And it's exactly the same principle. An habitation of God is a dwelling place for God. It's the believers. It was never about a building. It was a building. It became the centerpiece of their worship, but it was full of lessons. It was always about the individuals. It was always about our brothers and sisters. It was always about standing together. It was always about being built on the foundation that God set out. You can imagine if they set the sockets in the ground without following the plan, and then they went to stand the boards in it. Well, the tenons were like 10 inches apart. You know, I'm pretty sure the sockets need to be 10 inches apart, right? And so it is spiritually. We've got to be built on the things that God has laid down. Jump over to 1 Peter 2. And verse 4, to whom coming, as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious, you also, he says, as living stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. And then again, he talks about the chief cornerstone, verse 6. But for us to become a true dwelling place of God, we have to allow a number of things to take place. Just like for the lady who brought her cutting board or her fruit bowl along and offered it as an offering to be used in the service of the tabernacle as an item of shittim wood, she had to allow that something would have to happen to that cutting board or that fruit bowl in order for it to be incorporated. And so it is with us. We come to God, we're willing, but God has to change us. He can't use us as we are. And that's, you know, we know that as a theory, but often we resist the cutting and shaping process, don't we? We just want to be as we are. We don't really want to change. We don't want to have to fit in. We don't want to be dovetailed in and hemmed in and work with others. And so, again, there's amazing lessons that Paul, in writing to the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians, he says, come out from among them and be separate and be holy. Touch not the unclean thing. I will receive you. So we're invited. God invites us to willingly be a part of this heavenly house. But to do so, we have to separate from and we have to separate to, don't we? And we have to be willing to be repurposed and to be reshaped. And so the process of change, or the process of shaping, of course, is painful sometimes. And in 2 Corinthians, actually there's a word that's used in the New Testament a lot that's really, I think, speaks really strongly to this. 2 Corinthians, for instance, 3 and 18. Says, but we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed, into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. And changed, as probably most of us know, that changed is the word metamorphosis, right? We're changed like from a bug into a butterfly. And you know, the fruit bowl was great and the cutting board was great, but it wasn't going to work to make a board in the temple unless it was changed. Just like the caterpillar is great as a caterpillar, but he can't fly. No better than I can. So he had to be changed, he had to be shaped, and that's what we have to be. We have to be changed to conform to the image from glory to glory. And so we take, you know, think of an oak tree, or, you know, a gnarly oak tree that's grown in the open, not one that's grown in a forest where they grow tall, but, or maybe an arbutus on a rocky crag where it's all craggy. And you imagine you cut a piece of wood out of that, you're going to get a little bit that's going to be a little bit straight maybe, but some curly grain. And you think, what use is that, you know? And it's only useful after you've done a lot of work with it, right? It's not going to be any use until it's been changed or been transformed. And so it is with us. We have to be, Paul writes to the Romans, and he says in chapter 12, he says, we need to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. So it's a day-by-day process. And this was our Lord, wasn't it? The Word was made flesh because he spent time and he pondered things like the tabernacle. Jesus understood the boards. He understood the layout. He understood the garments that the priest wore. He understood the skins that went over and the loops and the clasps that held the curtains together, right? Speaking of, there's so many lessons of fellowship, for instance. There's fellowship lessons in the boards. There's fellowship lessons in the tenons. There's fellowship lessons in the hooks and clasps. There's fellowship lessons everywhere. God has always called us to work together. It's not the easiest. How much easier would it be for us to just do it alone? Let's just do it by Skype. We don't have to have any of the interpersonal issues that we have, right? But that's not what God called. He called his people together in the wilderness and he made them a congregation. And he's called us to be changed through that process to be more like him, to be in his image. Paul in Ephesians 2, he talks about the whole body being fitly joined together by that which every joint supplies. And he describes the ecclesia, the family of God, as a house, but he also describes it as a body. He says, you can't just say, well, I'm an eye and you're a foot and I don't need you because we're just about eyes, right? And so this analogy or this lesson that comes from the temple or the tabernacle which is really the same in the temple, is the same lesson that he's teaching us about the body. We're a body. We're a composite. And God teaches us that we're not, in fact, independent. We're interdependent. We can't say to another part of the body, we don't need you. We're going to stand alone. We're going to be a board standing in the wilderness. That's not a tabernacle. One board or one cutting board that didn't want to be shaped. So we got all these boards joined together and we got a cutting board nailed on the side of the tabernacle because the cutting board didn't want to be changed. And it's kind of silly when you think about it, but sometimes we can be like that, can't we? We can be intransigent. And so there's all kinds of lessons that come to us about fellowship and support. There's very strong lessons about support that we work together. We support one another. We have the Bible records that the very first person to ever leave the truth said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Well, he was. Well, he wasn't. But he should have been. Yeah, we are our brother's keeper. But Cain said, "I'm not my brother's keeper. I don't know where he is." You know, God didn't wait very long to bring that lesson to us, did he, in the Bible? Yeah, we are our brother's keeper. We are there to support one another because sometimes I need you and sometimes you need me. And so these lessons come to us so strongly out of this temple structure. And then we have, back in Ecclesiastes, just a couple more. Ecclesiastes, of course, gives us lots of very pithy thoughts. So Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Verse 9 to 12. He says, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they can have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken." So he speaks of the benefit of having two or more. He speaks of the benefit of support, of fellowship. And truthfully, is not the word exhortation, does that not embody that idea? The exhortation is to draw one alongside. It is literally to come up alongside of somebody and put your arm on their shoulder and walk with them. And that's what we do together. We encourage one another. We support one another. We fellowship one another. We speak of the things that are difficult for us or the things that excite us, and of our joys and of our griefs. Two is better than one. Just like the two tenons. Why two tenons? Why is there two tenons on the bottom of every board? They had rods passing through. They couldn't rotate. But it's lessons. It's stability. And there's just so many things that we can think of. And I don't think for all of the different thoughts that we might have as to what could have been the lessons that were behind it, I don't think any of them would be wrong. I think all of them are there. It's food for thought. That's what God's doing. He wants us to think about why was he so specific? Why did he say that? Why didn't he say use the cedars of Lebanon? Right? They could have got one plank. It would have been light, not a hardwood. Right? And it could have been one board. It would have been just so much easier. But it's never God's way, is it? Never God's way. Proverbs 27 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so a man the countenance of his friend." Again, this is working together. This is unity together. This is fellowship. And we can think again of so many examples from the scriptures of people like David and Jonathan. Neither stood alone. They stood together. They were there for each other. Daniel and his three friends. We think of, you know, in our lives, the special relationships that parents have with their children. And we're going through the point where the roles are reversed, you know, and you, as a young child, you're cared for by your parents, and then as a parent, you care for your children, and then as age moves by, you care for your parents, right? But it's the same principle. It's support, and it's true in life. It's true in marriage, and it's true in the ecclesia. And so this morning, as we come to consider Christ, who is represented in everything about the tabernacle, everything about the tabernacle is representative of Christ. Christ is the purpose. He's the reason. He's the structure. He's the boards. He's the bar that shoots through the middle, holding it together. He is the covering. He is the ark. He is the mercy seat. He is the lampstand. He is the altar. And he is the priest. And when we think about all of that, it's almost spine-chilling. And the work of unifying us together, if we focus in just on one little aspect of the planks that are used in the temple, is his work. And he's going to cover us with fine gold, and he's repurposing us now for use in the kingdom age. And Paul writes to the Corinthians and he says, "For in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily." He was, brothers and sisters, and is the Word made flesh. And that Word for him was the Old Testament. And the Old Testament for us, when we dig into it, has amazing lessons that can invigorate us and sustain us, in fact, and change us on our walk too, to the kingdom.